On this episode of the Guidewire podcast, I had the fortune of talking to Jackie Quay, Director of Licensing and Innovation Support at the UNC Office of Technology Commercialization, about the basics of technology transfer. Moving good ideas out into the world where they can help others is core to the mission of Fast Tracks and many of our listeners as well. So we wanted to provide some insight on the process. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation. We are the boots on the ground inside of healthcare working to uncover and solve high-impact, unmet medical needs.
Welcome to the Guidewire podcast. I'm your host, Devin Hubbard, and today I'm excited to be joined by none other than Jackie Quay, the Director of Licensing and Innovation Support at UNC Office of Technology and Commercialization. And I'm really excited because we haven't not had an opportunity on this podcast yet to talk about the topic of technology transfer. And so this is likely to be the first of many of these types of conversations. So Jackie, thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome.
I know I didn't do justice to you and when I introduced you. Can you give me a little bit about your background? Like, how did you get where you are?
So I started off my career in the lab. I'm a biologist, immunologist by training. And I was in the lab for 15 years, decided I wanted to try something different. So I went to law school. So I am an attorney. I'm licensed in North Carolina and Georgia. I also took the patent bar exam, so I am a patent attorney. And having done all of that, I really, really liked research and academia, so I didn't really want to totally leave. So tech transfer for me was the perfect opportunity to stay involved and stay in academia and get, you know, stay involved with research, but also use what I'd learned and gone on to school for. So
really prompts a question. So I have to ask, like, was there a particular experience that led you to change in the direction of law? I mean, in particular in tech transfer, I mean, having spent that long in biology and in life sciences, I have to imagine there was some experience that triggered that, or?
There was actually, and all things tech transfer are driven by the economy, and my decision was as well. So this is a long time ago, but the economy was not good. I had a master's degree that I got while working, but to get the PhD, I was going to have to quit my job. And I was working with people who were in their third, fourth, and fifth year of postdoc and no job in sight. And I decided a PhD wasn't a good idea. And at least in this area, there weren't a lot of small companies at that time. So Burroughs Wellcome was still here. And I didn't realize that there were industry jobs out there, or maybe there weren't because the economy was so bad. So I decided I was just going to go for something totally different. And the law school was just kind of doors accidentally open. You know, you take an exam and you do well, and then you apply and you think, oh, they'll never accept me, but they did. It was that kind of stuff.
That's kind of cool. I'm trying to draw the line from biology and academia to, you know, tech.
There is no line. I just tried things. And if I did well at them, I thought, okay, if I do well at it, then I probably will like it. And if somebody, you know, if I knocked on a door and somebody let me in, I went in.
Hey, that makes a lot of sense to me. So you ended up working in the field of now tech transfer after experience in law school. So I think what the listeners for this podcast, I'd like to get from this conversation is a general overview of what technology transfer is, and maybe a little bit about how it works at a large academic center. I work, you know, primarily, as you know, in the field of biomedical engineering. So we tend to have a lot of device designs and development. So we work pretty frequently with you guys, but I imagine there's probably listeners to this podcast that are in a similar situation and might be wondering, like, how do I even navigate the idea, like, of moving my own ideas out of the university? Or, hey, I have a great idea, but I'm a researcher. I'd love for this to save lives or do something outside of the university. I think there's a pathway for those as well that we could talk about. So anyway, do you mind giving a quick overview of what is technology transfer? Like, what is the idea of it? And kind of what are some of the steps that go into it typically?
Just so you know, so I've been in tech transfer offices at UNC, at Duke, and also for the federal government, Centers for Disease Control. So whether you're generally, if you're in the nonprofit world, whether it's an independent nonprofit research organization, academic center, the federal government, this is all going to be the same for these types of institutions. Most researchers, not all, but most researchers develop the questions that they're pursuing because there's, you know, they see value to the answer. Now, sometimes the value in the answer is just answering some very basic science question. But a lot of times people are really trying to solve problems that somebody else might benefit from that solution. And those are really the instances where tech transfer comes in, because sometimes you can solve a problem and you can just publish your paper and you can tell the world, hey, here's the answer. And those who need that answer can use it. But many, many, many times you can tell people what the answer is, but they still can't use it. A simple example is developing a treatment for a disease. You might identify a compound that would be suitable for treating a particular disease, but that doesn't mean that somebody can then actually avail themselves of that answer. There's a lot that has to happen. And basically, technology transfer is that moment at which the university says, I'm done. I do research here. I've found a possible answer, but I don't do development and I don't sell things. So somebody else is going to have to do that. And so in tech transfer, our goal is to transfer the technology that we developed so that somebody will pick it up. And that somebody is usually a company, pick it up and turn it into a product that somebody can buy so that they can actually avail themselves of that solution.
Yeah. Okay. So this prompts another question, you know, for listeners that might not have any experience with this process. I'm thinking of like a grad student, right? When should I start talking to your office? And you mentioned this sort of at some point, the researcher says, I'm done. This is done research. Like what, where's that line? I know it's not going to be the same for everybody, but as a general rule, like what would you advise somebody who's totally brand new to graduate school who might be developing a new idea or thinks they might have a new idea? Like how, what's the right process to go through, or what would you advise?
First of all, our door is always open. So at any point in time, no matter how early you are, if you have questions or you want to bat around some ideas about where you're headed, we're happy to discuss. And we have research capabilities that are focused on, you know, commercial markets and those sorts of things, not the kind of scientific research that you'd be doing that are helpful to just talk about. The moment that we begin taking action as opposed to having conversations. So again, conversations anytime. The moment at which we begin taking action, especially in academia, is before you publish. And remember that publication includes presenting at a meeting. So poster, talk, any of those in public that anybody can attend, that's a publication. That's the moment in time where we really need to sit down and evaluate what it is and make a decision about whether we think there's a path forward commercially so that the tech transfer activities can begin. That is because for many, but not all things that we transfer out, we file patent applications to protect them. And your patent application has to be filed prior to publication. So we do have an online invention disclosure form. Most universities do have them online at this point. Even if you've never talked to the tech transfer office prior, you can always just go submit your invention disclosure, and that's going to prompt somebody to contact you and talk about your invention. Later, still do it. Maybe something can still be fished out, or maybe it doesn't need to be patented. But publication is the one thing to remember if you're a grad student.
I just had this conversation with a collaborator of mine this morning about a technology that we've been developing and what the next step would be. And that's so prudent and interesting that came up. Yeah. Yeah. It's the exact same thing. And if you're going to disclose your idea anywhere that could be considered public, then it could compromise your IP. So that's helpful to know. I mean, I think if I were advising a grad student, I'd probably say the same thing, which is people in tech transfer, at least in my experience, are incredibly helpful at answering questions about whether, I've had conversations with our representatives specifically about whether this is even something that's worth patenting, doesn't even have commercial potential. And I think they've been really helpful, not only in my own understanding of what is and is not, I won't say patentable, but something that, where that line is for most of the things that I'm working on, but also just to understand more generally, like what is the process of step-by-step sequence of how to do things. So I can say that in my experience, at least, it's usually we have a conversation and then we may submit a report of invention or invention disclosure form. And then at that point, there's a review process, at least that we've done or you guys do. And then a conversation with anybody who might be an inventor. And then let's say, for example, that we choose to file, right? So researcher, grad student, postdoc, whoever comes to you guys and says, hey, I have this idea. You write it all down, file provisional, file a full, whatever it may be. What typically happens next?
So when we're evaluating the invention, we're looking at two things. We're looking at, is it patentable? And that's not the only essential component, right? We commercialize things that we don't patent. But the other thing that we look at that I think probably most people or a lot of people in academia don't think about too much is it commercializable? Of course, that includes, is there a market for it? Would somebody buy it? But it also includes questions like, can you find a way to sell it? So to sell something, you either have to put it in a box and deliver a physical thing, or you have to provide a service, or you have to make things in a special way. And we do get inventions that, for example, some methods. We might get invention disclosures on a method, and methods are patentable. But because the method will always be carried out behind closed doors, and the product that is made using the method, it doesn't have a tag on it, I was made using this method. We look at those and say, there's no way to determine whether or not somebody else is practicing this method. There's just no way. For example, very hesitant to file on those because we have no way to actually protect it.
Yeah, that brings up a really interesting question that I hadn't really thought about. I mean, for trade secrets, as an example, let's say I'm doing research at a university and I have a process that I've developed or a method for, I don't know, let's say synthesizing a new drug. Or maybe it's the same drug that's already out there, but a new synthesis method, period. What do we do with that? If I want to publish that, it sort of puts in direct competition the idea of commercialization and publishing this in the literature. What happens with those awkward sort of situations? Or does that even arise frequently enough to worry about?
No, it arises a lot. And there's two sort of black and white extremes, and then we're really dealing with everything in between. But one extreme is this. It's a method, and I'll use an example. My examples are usually biology, sorry. I'm old enough to have been in the lab pre-PCR. So when polymerase chain reaction was first discovered and patented, the companies that were commercializing it initially tried to enforce their patents against research labs. And it was impossible. It was just impossible. They could not know what people were doing in every lab across the country and around the world. They very quickly realized they were never going to be able to give a handle on it, and they gave up. They tried to do it by patenting the polymerases and patenting the machines, but people just came out with different machines and different polymerases. So it just got out of hand very quickly. So they narrowed their focus to the clinical diagnostics. And they made their money there. So clinical diagnostics was much more prescribed. You have to adhere to rigorous standards and report to the FDA how you're doing things. So that was something they could get a handle on and monitor. So, you know, an example of a method that wasn't really enforceable, at least on the research side. So it was just not going to work.
So if a similar technology were to get invented at, let's say, UNC, for example, and an inventor came to you and said, hey, I have this idea. I want to publish it in a journal. What would the response be? I mean, I know you're not necessarily there to coerce anybody in one direction or another in terms of commercializing or not. What would your reply to that be?
I would focus on the market and the protectability rather than, and the, you know, the value does it provide. So take CRISPR as an example. CRISPR is a method that inserts itself into the product that's sold. So it's much easier to know that if somebody is doing something, they're actually using CRISPR. Same with Prelox years ago and some of these other engineering methods. It's much easier to police what people are doing. And therefore, you can have a much more protectable market space. Something like that, we'd look really hard at patenting and trying to, you know, find market uses for it. As opposed to those methods that whatever the product that's made, there's nothing in it that tells you how it was made.
And then if I put my my design instructor hat on for a second, for student teams that work with me, if I spotted something like that, I'd say this is perfect for trade secret, right? If it's not something that's easy to recreate, you know, if it's essentially a black box process and you get to the other side, I can look at your product and have no way of determining how this was put together. And if there's no... like if the product itself does not have any enforceable intellectual property, you could say, oh, well, this feature or whatever could be infringing. Then, yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, recipes, chemical formulations, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I will say important for students to know about, but protecting a trade secret in academia is a problem because if you're going to publish work, it's no longer a trade secret.
Exactly. That's what I was getting at with the sort of contrast between commercialization and publication in that particular instance is, you know, if you're a grad student, that's a whole different ballgame. Because now, I mean, we don't have to get into the weeds on that. Because to some degree, I guess you could argue there's a bit of a conflict there because you could either publish it and graduate or you could commercialize it and then look for something else to publish. And maybe there's a middle ground, but...
Well, it's still good for people to know because some grad students are going to go into industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
And rely heavily on trade secret, heavily.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not that I didn't have a great graduate school experience because I feel like I did. I think that's something I wish I knew ahead of time. Luckily, I worked with an advisor who happened to have a lot of experience with this. But I think if I were going into another lab where maybe the advisor had not gone through commercialization process or even wasn't familiar with it, I may not even get exposed to the knowledge that there's an option, right? But anyway, I think it's a fascinating...
It's something good to know, though. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, for the folks that are listening, I think that's the point, right? Is to understand your options. And that's why one of the reasons I think these conversations with folks like you are so important. Anyway, so, okay. I come to you guys. We figure out, hey, let's patent this. What happens next?
This is where we get to something that if you ever hear the word Valley of Death, this is it. So we've identified the invention. We've figured out that we have a way to protect it. Maybe it's copyright, maybe it's patent, maybe it's a service that we think we can just focus on quality. Now there's this gap between academia says this isn't research anymore, right? I'm a grad student. I have to publish in a big journal. If I develop this, that's not really going to get me a Cell paper. And we want to give it to a company who's going to turn it into a product. This is where the companies come in and they're looking for product lines to add or improvements or things to license that they can develop into products. They want to know that it's going to work and it's going to sell. And it's pretty rare that we've taken it that far. So an awful lot of inventions never make the leap across what's called the Valley of Death because they haven't gone far enough down one side to get up the other side. It's a combination of a lack of resources, a lack of places that do this kind of middle ground work, and a lack of funds to pay for that kind of work. So we spend the next year, 2 years, we work very closely with the inventors. So we can't do this alone. Our expectation is that we'll go out and look for companies, but also that the inventors, when they go to meetings, if a company comes up and is interested in their idea, or if they see a representative from a company, they go up and talk to them and say, hey, your company does oncology drugs. I've developed something that I think you'd be really interested in. We do that as well. We go to meetings as well. But really, at the end of the day, if I engage interest, I'm going to be bringing that company back to the scientists so they can ask more scientific questions. So that's sort of the third arm that we're looking for when we do evaluate is that we've got inventors who are engaged and want to see this go forward. So we spend the next year to 2 years looking for somebody who's willing to take a license and willing to spend the money, do the development. That is why we file the patent applications or look for ways to protect things is they generally aren't going to spend the money if they can't have an exclusive market when they go to sell their product. Because especially if you're talking about drugs, it could be upwards of $1 billion that they're going to spend.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I think that sheds a lot of light on the process, especially on the back end. And for those that are not familiar with the Valley of Death, it's like the proverbial description of a place where most technologies tend to fail early on, where there's that like, okay, we got it up to the point where we can say, yeah, we proved the concept in a lab maybe, but converting that into something that's actually commercializable, that actually can be packaged and manufactured at scale, those sorts of things. I think that's the value you're referring to. And you also answered the next question I was going to ask, which is sort of what happens to help mitigate that. As you described, you basically go pound the ground and find people and companies that might be interested in licensing. And before we started recording, we were talking about this. And at least in my experience, it seems like there's a couple major categories. There's the, at least my experience tends to be more on the, hey, I'm a faculty member. I have an invention. I'm interested in spinning this idea out. Maybe I even have a startup company. And then there's the other kind of side, at least from my perspective, and feel free to add more or correct me on this, but there seems to be the other option of finding a big company or one that might already have a portfolio that they're looking to expand. Is there a difference between those two processes in terms of what you see
Ultimately is, but in the short term, what we typically do is we start off just looking for companies, existing companies.
Is that just easier to do in terms of like the barrier to getting it, like the licensing barrier? Or?
It can be easier. But the real reason we do that is even if we have a faculty member who comes in the door with their invention and says, I want to start a company, it's really valuable to talk to companies in the field and hear their feedback on the invention. And they often will ask questions or make comments that we or our faculty members haven't thought about. So it's valuable information gathering, even if the faculty member is very intentionally wanting to start a company. You learn things that you wouldn't have known that will help you start your company. The other thing we have is we have a lot of times faculty members who had no intention of starting a company. We tried to license the technology and over again, we heard too early, too early, too early. And so we all realized that the only way to get this out there is to put it into a startup company because they're the only ones, they're formed around that particular technology solely for the purpose of moving it forward. You know, some people do a startup company because they always wanted to, but a lot of people do it because there was no alternative.
I think that makes a lot of sense. What does that look like, though? I mean, so I'm imagining putting myself in that situation. I'm not a good example because I tend to like doing that kind of work. Startup is interesting to me. But, you know, I imagine there's a lot of folks that are like, I already told you, I'm not interested in startup stuff. What do you guys do on that one? Do you try and assemble a team or is there... What does that normally look like, I guess, for listeners that might be in a situation where, hey, I'm in grad school, I'm not going to graduate for 3 years, or I'm a new faculty member, I got to get my publication record up so I can get tenure. What happens there?
Most, at least the large academic institutions, have built up programs around getting technologies across the valley of death, both startup programs, but also what's called gap funding. Some people call it other things, but usually called gap funding. Small amounts of money. And I think that the one thing we really like to see is not that we're necessarily talking about a startup company and the business side of things, but what we're really talking about is what is the technology? What have we heard or what do we know is missing? What are the steps to fill those missing pieces and what are they going to cost? Then we would all sit down and say, okay, one missing piece, $50,000, a little bit of gap funding, maybe use a CRO and get the answer. Then we can go back to those companies who said, gee, if you could answer this one question, well, okay, we've answered it affirmatively. Obviously, if it was a negative, we wouldn't be going back. If it's 10 questions and several million dollars, that's probably a startup company. But it's really helpful if in those situations, the focus can be on the technology and what's necessary. And I'll pick an easy example. You have a drug delivery platform and the research model that you used delivered a drug in a disease model that is not actually a drug used in humans. It was just convenience for research purposes. This drug's available in the Sigma catalog. I have this disease model up and running in the vivarium or in cell lines. So this is the disease I picked and this is the drug I picked. And a company says, gee, I'm really interested, but I need to know that it will work on my drug. So a gap funding project could be just reproducing the same set of experiments, either here or at a CRO, using the drug from the company, show them that that drug delivery platform would work for their drug. You know, the other extreme is you might have a manufacturing method, a platform manufacturing method that could make many, many, many things. And there needs to be a lot of time and effort building up the manufacturing process and exploring what are the best things to make. That might be several million dollars. That's more of a startup company scenario. Same sort of thing, though. You're going to be pursuing gap funding to get that off the ground. Gap funding would be SBIR, STTR from the federal government. This university and many universities offer grants directly to companies. There are many nonprofits, you know, the NC Biotech Center, NC IDEA, for example, in North Carolina. Most states have programs like this that offer gap funding types of money. All of them still, you know, when you go in and apply for that money, you're going to have to say, here's my technology. Here's what's missing. Here's how much money I need to fill in the missing pieces. And then you apply for your grant. But it's the same process every time.
I guess the question I have that surrounds that is like, who's going to do that? If I'm a PI and I'm just like not interested, I don't have time or it doesn't fit into my research career or whatever it may be. Do you guys help with team assembly as well? Or
we try. And it's totally understandable. And we very much appreciate that this isn't for everybody, because it's really a big time suck and a big learning curve and a lot of work. This is where it's particularly hard in our geographic area. So if you're in Boston or New York or Northern California, there are entrepreneurs on every corner looking for their next idea that they're, you know, and they don't come up with all the ideas, right? But their expertise is building companies, right? So they can take a technology they understand and they can build a product and a company out of it. And they're just looking for things. The number of people available to do that in smaller regional areas is limited. So it's much harder to assemble a team. Now, if COVID doesn't teach us anything, maybe it'll teach us we can work more virtually than we think.
That's an interesting thought. I love that, because I hadn't considered how that would affect the entrepreneurial and investment community.
I would hope that it would open things up, because I would say we've more than once had investors look at tech, or, you know, potential entrepreneurs look at technologies, but they really feel like they need to be closely working with the inventor at the beginning. And the thought of moving here, lots of people like to move here. I love it here. But they're always saying, well, if this company doesn't make it, because many don't, where will I get my next one? You know, it's not Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah, I had a conversation that was very similar to this, you know, a couple of years ago with a seasoned investor in the area here. And we were talking about this exact thing. I asked him, I was like, why isn't there more med tech and startup community here? And his answer was, well, it's simple. If I'm an entrepreneur and my idea doesn't make it, I can't just call my buddy up down the road and look for another idea. I have to go back to Boston or to the Midwest or to, you know, the hubs where you find med tech or pharmaceuticals if you're doing biotech sort of work. So, although I'd like to think that this area is getting a little better, but
I think it is getting better. You know, I've been at UNC actually since 2004. I left for a couple of years, but then I came back. It's definitely better than it used to be. And I do think the world is changing, and our ability to work not in the same place, not just because of COVID, right? But everything, our ability to work collaboratively when we're in far-flung places is really advancing quickly. So more and more, I would hope that we can assemble teams around technologies where we don't need the people to move here to do that.
I think that would be fantastic. I think you're right. I hadn't thought of it like that, you know, in terms of the impact of COVID, but I think that makes a lot of sense. And even without realizing it, I've already had conversations and situations that have arisen that normally wouldn't have, simply because of having everybody getting comfortable with video and phone call visits and working together. Myself included in this, you know, there's people that I work with that I have never met, and it doesn't really seem to affect our productivity, interestingly enough. And maybe I'm an outlier, or maybe that's just sort of a unique situation. But yeah, that's kind of an interesting observation that I hadn't really considered. But to bring it back just really quickly before we kind of wrap things up, I wanted to bring it back to the listeners here, because I think, again, the idea of getting a technology out the door might be difficult, or might be easier if you're in a location where there's, you know, as you put it, an entrepreneur on every corner. But if I'm not in that kind of area, I mean, I think one of the critical factors is team assembly. Do you think it would be a wise idea if I'm a PI or a graduate student to start working on building that team to roll it out? Or is that something that I would work with tech transfer on, or business school, or what? I'm just trying to think of like what practical advice we could give to folks that are maybe thinking, you know, I have a great idea, but I'm not the person who's going to take it across the finish line.
Yeah. So this is the same advice that you give graduate students looking for jobs. It's networking. I always tell everybody, I've never applied for a job and gotten it. Every job I've ever had in my life was through networking first, and then I applied for the job. It's the same thing in assembling a team. And I think this is a really important thing for people to think about, because I think people want to assemble a team very quickly and they just pull in their closest friends. And those people may not be the right people. So going back to the same concept, right? Don't jump to the market if you've got a technological invention. If it's a service and you're going straight to market, fine. If it's a technological invention, think about problem solving first. If you put together your, here's my technology, here's the missing pieces, here's how I could get them, that's how you should assemble your team. Who will be the best group of people to solve these problems to get it over the finish line? They may not be the people to run the company down the road. They are the right people to get the technology moved forward. And you should always have that in mind as you build your team. And so that's where then you begin networking. I need somebody who knows how to make or engineer this kind of component. How do I find that person? I start networking. I look for people with expertise that I may not deal with on a day-to-day basis because I don't make this kind of thing, but I know it's an important component of my device. So now I'm going to have to like do this 6 degrees of separation to find my cousin's sister-in-law who knows somebody who makes these for a living. But that's who I need, right? So it's that focusing on the problem-solving aspect and finding the people who can solve the problems.
Having gone through something just like that very recently, I totally agree with that advice. I think that finding the right people is absolutely critical. And the other thing I was just thinking about too is, you know, in Fast Tracks, we're kind of an odd duck in that manner because, you know, our real intent is to try and get technologies to the point where we can get them out the door easier. So I think it'll be interesting because part of, while we can do some of that networking to start building some of the teams, we also have the ability to de-risk our technologies, I think, a little bit more because of who's on our team already. And whether members of our team remain involved in the startup companies, if any, that come out of what we're doing, for people that are listening and thinking about what options are available, one of the interesting things that for folks at UNC, at least, you can always come chat with us, right? Like, so I was going to say for Jackie, if you're finding folks that are like, man, I really need an engineer to take a look at blank, that's exactly what we can help with, because it's very possible that we can help de-risk or like fill in that gap if there's a company that's already interested in licensing or if somebody's working on a startup company. So
no, it's an amazing service to have. I mean, and it's important because especially with UNC not having an engineering school, it's really tough.
Yeah. And well, luckily we have NC State down the road and they collaborate very closely with us. Interestingly enough, an example of where distance does matter. I mean, I think if NC State was right here, you know, in our backyard, which I guess some might consider it in our backyard, but meaning like you could walk to it, I think that would be a completely different, we'd be having a totally different conversation, right?
Well, the other thing you get with that, and again, how will video change? But, you know, a lot of my conversations with people are walking down the sidewalk and they come out of their building. And it's like, oh, hey, and we start chatting, or we're coming through the parking lot and we start chatting. And those are the kinds of conversations that don't happen, even though it's only 10 miles or 15 miles down the road.
You're totally right, because somebody has to initiate it. And it's not just a collision of particles. Funny story on that topic, Fast Tracks. We have a community chat that we use to communicate with each other on a daily basis. And we were just literally this last week sort of bemoaning, man, we really miss running into people. And so we actually created a specific chat channel called the Water Cooler. And it's, you know, like the exact sort of situation where you run into somebody, you know, as you're walking down the street or getting lunch or whatever it may be. We decided to create a channel called Water Cooler, where if somebody's just working on something or needs a quick break, they can open up a call on the channel. It sends a notification to everyone else that just says, hey, I'm taking a break if you want to come chat. And it has been awesome. We've had some really hilarious conversations and really productive conversations that have had absolutely nothing to do with engineering, but have...
But sometimes amazing things come out of them, even if nothing other than, I didn't know you knew how to do that. Year later, you need that, and you remember that conversation you had, and you go back to that person.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Yep, completely. That's so funny that you brought that up, because we just were talking about this exact situation. But
that's a good idea. I think we're going to have to do that in our office.
Well, I'll let you know how it goes. We've only been trying it for a week, and so far it's been pretty good. I think it still suffers from that same issue of remembering to initiate, but it's a lower barrier because you just sort of say, open a video instead of saying, oh, I need to talk to this specific person. So, but anyway, well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. I think that was a really enlightening conversation. And I hope that it gave our listeners a little bit of a peek on how technology transfer works. I'm sure I'm going to bother you again to come back on this podcast, because I know there's plenty more to discuss on the technology transfer side of things that we didn't even get a chance to talk about today. But I just want to thank you again for joining me, and I appreciate it. And, you know, I'm sure I'll be running into you quite frequently. If not on the street, I'm sure I'll be bothering you via email, because, you know, you guys and your whole team are awesome. So thanks again. Really appreciate you joining us today.
Yeah.
Hopefully today's discussion provided some insight on technology transfer and moving ideas out of a university into the commercial world. If you have any thoughts or questions about today's episode, please send a message to guidewire@unc.edu. Follow us on Twitter @GuidewirePod. For more content like this, consider subscribing to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite streaming service. As always, I'm your host, Devin Hubbard, and we will talk to you next time.
Learn more about our exciting activities, opportunities, and team by subscribing to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite listening service. If you have identified an unmet medical need or are interested in learning more about our process, visit us at guidewire.unc.edu. You have been listening to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation.